I have these friends, Dan and Sheila. Actually, they're podcast hosts.
Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
And we are back for more Millennium. Two interesting episodes this week. One that is exactly as good as I remembered it, and one I didn't remember at all. And I don't think I can be faulted for not remembering A Single Blade of Grass at all. Right?
The funny thing is that I...
You did remember this one?
Maybe you didn't see it.
Maybe this is the one episode I missed or something like that.
Yeah, you might have had something else to do that night.
Yeah, it happened and didn't tape it. You know, these things happen. Yeah. But it's like, I did not remember this episode. And it's...
I did.
Okay. Whatever you say, better or worse, has one of the funniest setups and payoffs, you know, I've ever seen in my life. It really is. Like, if you look at this episode as, like, if you read it just as a structure for an amazing joke, it's quite a success. I don't think that's all this episode is trying to do. But I'm also not going to say that it doesn't have a hilarious joke. Because it does have a hilarious joke.
Okay, well, you will tell me what the hilarious joke is.
Oh, no, I will get there.
When we get there, but... and then I'll say, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. This is very funny. Yeah, I get it now.
I don't know what you do with this A Single Blade of Grass.
Yeah, okay, so it starts in New York City. Well, we don't know it's New York City right away. It's actually quite a nice scene where a bunch of guys are in a dark room having some kind of a ritual that is coded as being Native American. Yeah. Based on the costumes, based on the race of the guys, right? It's clear what's going on here. And one of the guys is given hallucinogens and, given hallucinogens... And then snake venom, right? But he's like, he's been chosen to be the one, is what we're told. And then we pull the camera back out and we find out, Daniel. Woo! Yeah.
Woo!
But of course, I think that's also a reference to the hallucinatory book of Daniel. And yes. Commentaries on apocalypses. On apocalypses. Yep. Like, I think that name is very specifically chosen in this context.
Oh, yes. We consider it the first of the apocalypses.
Yeah.
Written.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a reason it's such an important part of the Schofield Reference Bible.
Yeah.
And the whole idea of the Antichrist starting out there, right?
Yeah.
It all starts in Daniel. But anyway. So yes, it's not accidental that this guy was named Daniel. It's not a coincidence. It all fits in. But what's really interesting about it is the camera pulls back out of this thing. We find out they're in the basement of a high-class hotel.
Yes.
You know, they are not in a cave somewhere. They are literally in downtown Manhattan in a very high-end hotel. So this is a weird situation we're looking at. So then it's the next day. We see some archaeologists working on a building site, digging up an ancient corpse. And as they're digging, they find the body of the guy who just got killed in the previous scene. They find Daniel's body. And of course, oh hell, we're going to have to call in Frank to figure out what's going on with this.
Yeah, well, that was the cop says, this is just too weird.
I needed
your friend.
I knew to call in the Millennium group. This is just too weird. I'm just hands off. I haven't touched this at all. Like, we have not. Yeah. We haven't touched anything.
Any part of this.
Yeah. This is too weird for us. I did like that a lot, actually.
Yeah.
So Frank looks over the body, and there's a weird thing where I'm like, is this supposed to be his power? Or is this supposed to be, or is like, you know, the way they've arranged the set is not reflecting what's in the script? Because he says that he wasn't killed here because, you know, such violence was done to the body, there'd be blood anywhere and there's not a trace of it in
everywhere.
The dirt. But the problem is, at that point, only his face has been uncovered. And so is this a staging issue or is this psychic?
Okay,
yes, it is his powers.
No, he did have these they were so fast that you couldn't see what they were.
Yeah. Yeah, the flashes.
He did have flashes to this man's death.
But the reason I wondered whether this was an issue of staging is none of the other characters are surprised when he says this. Like, no one comments on the fact that, well, you can only see a face.
Well, no. The female archaeologist does say, well, how do you know that? Or the cops
say, what she says, how do you know that, is to the fact that he was moved. And then he explains the way that he knows that is because the body is mutilated. But no one asks him, how'd you know the body was mutilated, Frank?
Oh, anyway, okay. That's what you're referring to.
No one asks the follow-up question.
Well, maybe there was, we're missing 10 seconds of
You're right. You've always got to be cutting stuff for time in a show like this. But they do, you know, they go and they investigate. They investigate the body. And we find out that the body has been massively, they find the site first, don't they?
They find, yes. What they do is they find, because Frank does.
Yeah.
Because he knows and he looks over and stuff, and then they find another set of bones.
Yeah.
Okay, with a decayed mask, and it's about 200 years old.
And it's just like the mask that the dead guy is wearing. So this guy is essentially, you know, they're recreating the death of this other man 200 years earlier.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
It's an interesting way to do this, right?
Yeah. So then they go and Frank leads them to the place where the murder actually happened.
Yes.
And they find the pit. And in addition to all of the symbols that are drawn everywhere, he sees a symbol in his head, which is this, which is like this set of arced lines.
Yes.
That are of circular, but I mean, not really.
Sort of an oval.
Yeah.
And split straight down. So it's got four sections.
Exactly.
Right in the middle. And then two other.
Exactly. Curves. Two other lines. Yeah. Right. And so, but that symbol pointedly isn't there.
No.
It's not on the walls. It's just something he sees.
Yes.
Yeah. We have a fun scene where where he goes to see the forensic pathologist, a fun character.
Yes, the forensic pathologist.
The funky forensic pathologist archetype we've seen in so much fiction. And we find out that the body was cut into pieces and then sewn back together.
Back together again. Yeah.
And hacked to pieces with flint.
Yep.
Like not even with metal tools, with flint tools. And so, obviously, this has to do somehow with some kind of native ritual.
Yes.
But the problem is, they don't have an expert in that. Like, yes. Frank doesn't know about that.
And Frank has already seen these guys. There's a whole bunch of Native American guys
working on the project.
On the project, right?
Yeah.
They're, you know, because he asks the owner. And the owner says, oh, yeah, no, they're just laborers on the project, you know, and.
A weird true thing. There is a massive history of natives doing construction work, especially in New York State. It's an interesting quirk that historically, and people have debated whether this is a cultural thing or whether it's a physical thing, something about inner ears. But generally, there is no fear of heights among
Mohawks.
Mohawks specifically. No fear of heights whatsoever. And it's like, do they not have vertigo? Is it something in their ears? Is it a cultural thing? Who knows? But there's just no fear of heights. So you go up to the top of a building and they got no problem at all.
They got no problem working and they work on bridges.
Yeah.
Suspension bridges.
Exact same thing. Yeah, they don't get dizzy. They got no fear of heights.
Yeah.
As crazy as that sounds, like that there could be an entire group of people that don't. But yeah, like it's a known thing. And so it's not unusual to see a bunch of Native guys working construction in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not unusual at all, in fact.
A genetic quirk that...
Yeah. That end up giving them an incredibly marketable skill in our modern age.
Yeah.
All right, so... but yes, so Frank goes to talk to the native guys, one of whom is Floyd Red Crow Westerman.
Yeah.
Always great to see him.
Right?
Love that performer. Always great to see him in something other than like Walker, Texas Ranger. Not a good show, Walker, Texas Ranger.
And but we watched.
Oh, we watched it, but it's not a good show. It's the nicest thing you can say about Walker, Texas Ranger is that it was not very good. Yeah. But anyway, I mean, it's not like it was Kung Fu, The Legend Continues, but it was not a very good show. But more importantly, you know, Frank goes and he talks to them. And the interesting idea is, right, all of these guys are from different nations.
Yeah.
Because they ask him about Daniel's religion, right? And what this thing was. And the guy's like, you know, how the hell should I know about his faith? Yeah, I'm from a different tribe, you know? And as Frank, you know, it's like, you expect a Catholic to know what goes on inside a synagogue? And Frank's like, no, but I expect him to be able to recognize that it's another religion.
But what the thing is what you missed in here is that the archaeologist who has followed Frank into this looks at all of these
symbols on the walls.
There are all sorts of symbols on the walls. And
they're
mentioned
all from completely different.
Yeah. And that's what she says. But that one's Hopi. But that one is...
Yeah, they've got Algonquin stuff. They've Mohawk. Got Hopi stuff. They've got Mohawk stuff. They've got Ute stuff. They've got...
Free stuff. Yeah. They've Sioux got stuff. Charity stuff.
Yeah.
Not Sioux, Cherokee, she says. Yes. So yeah, she said there's all these
There's different. All of these different origins. Like there's no sense to it because she studies this stuff and she can't make heads or tails about how all of this stuff intertwines.
I don't know why she wasn't. To me, she wasn't a convincing archaeologist.
Really? You just didn't find her believable?
There was just something off. Hmm. I don't know whether it was the writing or whether it was, I think it was more the acting than the writing.
Okay. Her performance just didn't feel authentic to you. Okay.
I do know archaeologists.
That might be part of it.
When
you actually know people in that field, you're going to notice phoniness easily than someone else might. I get that completely. But yes, so you're right. And that's the big mystery. Why are these from all of these different faiths there? What's interesting is we don't, of course, Frank goes to confront these guys in a pool hall and shows them the symbol and asks them if they know what it means. The key symbol that she didn't recognize and asks them if they know what it means. And they all feign ignorance. And then the minute he leaves, they're like, how the hell... does he
well,
know?
He says he's the one.
Well, yeah, but that's what I'm saying. After he
and
leaves,
and you see the old shaman,
Floyd Red Crow Westerman.
Yes,
beloved actor Floyd Red Crow Westerman.
Yes, and so you see him, and
seeing that this is, and they specifically say this is who Daniel sent.
This is who Daniel sent.
Yeah,
Frank Black.
They said he sent Frank Black, and that's the key part. Because the idea from the exactly, because Frank came from Seattle. So the idea is in their religion, and this part I found a little confusing, the idea of the West and the East, is that like to go west is, you know, you have to be facing west, because west is the deadlands, and the idea is you send someone there and then you reassemble them to bring back a message. And what they believe, I mean, the guy didn't come back from the dead when he was reassembled because, you know, duh. But when Frank shows up, a guy literally from the West, they choose to interpret this as Frank has been brought, like essentially been brought back by Daniel to bring a message from the other world.
Yes. What our shaman says, yes, he came back with a message from Daniel. Yeah. But the thing is that the west is where the sun goes down.
Right. And so that makes sense, right? that would be the Deadlands. Yes.
Yes, that would be where the spirit world is in the west, west.
Mythologically, it makes perfect sense.
Yes.
I hadn't thought about that aspect of it. But now that you say it, of course that makes perfect sense.
Yes. So that's why he has to face west. That's why he goes to the west. And then this man, because what Frank says, not Frank Black.
Yeah.
Our shaman, I'll just call him our shaman.
Our shaman.
Says, right, is that, how did he put it? When they say, well, how did he know the symbol? And he said, well, Daniel gave it to him.
Yeah, because he's the one. One of the guys full on says that we didn't paint that symbol on the wall in the basement.
Yeah.
So there's no way he could have known it. And that's their evidence that they've been sent a message.
Well, and we know as well that Frank has been sent this message.
Yes. Yeah, because that's how Frank's powers work.
Yeah. So he's been sent a message. So they're not completely insane in interpreting it that
a message has been sent. Like, you're right. I mean, within this context, apart from all of their murderous nonsense, like, they are right that messages are being sent from the spirit world. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not wrong within the world of the show. And that's part of what makes this episode interesting, because we then cut to an explanation of what all this means. So the idea being that when tribes were split up hundreds of years ago, right?
Is that before we get to the understanding of the metal, where they find, where Frank finds, no, Frank in the earth?
Yeah, Frank, well, because what has happened is, so she has wanted them to, it's an earlier scene because it's before he goes to the guys.
Yeah.
Because what happens is, right, she has taken out all of the earth around the 200-year-old dead body.
Yes.
And somehow Frank is able to just reach into the dirt and know where, like, the prayer card is.
Yes, it's stone. It's carved stone.
Exactly, it's carved stone that you use as part of your prayer ritual, right? And it has the same symbol on it.
Yeah, at the top.
At the top of it. Yeah, it has the exact same symbol on it, so this must all be connected.
And she does understand some of it, but she has no idea what that symbol means.
Yeah.
Never seen it before. She does understand some of the others, and she does explain that these are a series of prayers,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, part of rituals.
Yeah.
But, yes, and then we get, yes, then afterwards we get that explanation from her about, is it from her about the lost tribe?
Yeah, it's from her about the lost tribe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she talks about, like, the various mythological things and the mysterious things that could happen. And this is where we get the idea of being able to remotely squeeze someone's heart until they die. Right.
Well, because she recognizes some of this. She recognized some of this as going back to, like, the mutilations and things like that, going back to the ghost dance.
Exactly.
Now, the problem with the ghost dance is that they all were massacred.
Yeah.
Right? And the ghost dance was set up to bring back, was supposed to bring back the buffalo. It was supposed to get rid of the white man.
Mm-hmm.
It was supposed to regenerate the earth, basically.
Yeah, the idea is, and that's where the title of the episode comes from. The idea of the ghost dance was it was supposed to, like you say, bring back the buffalo, get rid of the white men, and it was all going to start when the grasses returned. The grasses would return, and when the grasses returned, that would mean that the buffalo would come back, and then when the buffalo would come back, you know, they would have their hunting grounds again, and the white men would be gone. And that's what the concept of the single blade of grass is, because once that single blade of grass starts to grow, like, the process can't be stopped, is the idea.
Yes. And so, you know, so they slowly, so she does explain at least parts of this. Now, whether or not the lost tribe of the Ojibwe, and I mean, that was that part of it. And I'm going, well, I've never heard that particular story before.
That might be crafted just for this one. Yeah.
Or, you know, that somehow or another, there was a lost tribe of the Ojibwe. And all I could think of was the lost tribe of Israel. But
yeah, it's not accidental. But yes,
it was weird. And then, but they moved. But no, they weren't really lost. And they didn't all die. They just hid among all of the other tribes. Mm-hmm. Around North America, and
consequently, and this is the interesting part of her theory, that over these hundreds of years, their rituals were lost and forgotten, and so instead they started picking and choosing things from their adopted tribes,
yes,
to put into their faith, and that's a really interesting idea.
Yes, except that they maintain this because the whole point, right, because the 200-year-old man had also been cut up and sewn back together again. Mm-hmm. She could tell that. And the idea was that was supposed to, it's a resurrection symbol, it turns out, right? They are supposed to resurrect or... Ultimately, they have to go, well, yes, they made it to the other side. Now, nobody knows that except when Frank comes with the symbol, right? I mean, he's been shown the symbol in his visions, as opposed to it wasn't that he slaps down the symbol that was on the clay
stone tablet,
right?
Yeah.
No, he because he did that before he got the stone tablet.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's why. So it fits.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Anyway, and then so that's all this explanation going on.
And then they go back to the dig site to try and see if there's any more information there. And while they were being gone, the head of the construction company has had all of the remaining like dirt essentially just up and excavated and moved. By some college upstate.
Yes.
Because as he says, legally, all I have to do is make sure that a proper, you know, an archaeological group of some kind has carefully moved it and signed off on it. And so he just got somebody to do that.
Yes. And then he gets angry, like the archaeologist.
They start having a screaming fight with each other.
And then, you know, and you do see the young man who's basically leading this group, looking at him, and as he's having a heart attack, right? And you really wonder, and what they say, it's the squeezing the heart.
Yeah.
Because this,
which is supposed curse that they used to be able to do.
Yes. That the shamans could actually, a powerful shaman
could squeeze someone's heart, right? Yes. And make them die.
And this man dies of a heart attack. So it's all fitting into their prophecies. Yeah. Like these prophecies are one by one coming true. Not necessarily in the way they would think of it, but this was the bad white man, right? And he is building on an archaeological site. Well, I suspect half of Toronto is built on archaeology.
I know, right?
You know, and I'm sitting here going, but I'm just going, did nobody say, and what would you think? You know, because that's part of this thing now. They're starting to return artifacts and they're starting to return bodies and things.
Thank
and
I'm heavens. Going, yeah.
And I'm going, and every time somebody
questions it,
I'm sitting here going, so you want somebody to go out to Greenwood and start digging up
your relatives and talking about what this jewelry they're wearing says about their culture and their society? We can tell what kind of a position they had in society based on the amount of jewelry that was buried with the body.
Yeah, come on.
Is that something you want to see done? Because we can start doing that if that's how you'd prefer it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is what I told my class last night, too, I said, because they asked me about how much did we know about some of these early, like, Ishtar and things like that.
Yeah.
And I'm going, I could tell you that we know some, a lot, Mm-hmm. I said, I'll also tell you, we don't know a hell of a lot. I mean, yep. We know little pieces. We know how long, like it's thousands of years now that we can talk about the beginnings of legal codes.
Yep.
But we only have bits and pieces. And I said, and the real problem is that we can interpret it however we want right now, but they could find some archaeological dig something up that would throw it all out the window.
Yeah. Mike, because we are operating with limited, deeply imperfect evidence.
I said, plus, what can you tell from a burial site? Really? You can hypothesize all sorts of things, right?
Yep.
But what does it mean? We don't have the
slightest idea. We don't know what they meant by any of this stuff they're doing. It's all guesswork. They didn't write books about their funerary practices. We are reverse engineering this.
Yeah. You know, we have to hypothesize backwards from what we know from the late 19th century and the early 20th century. Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating.
But anyway, in this case, their prophecies slowly are coming true.
Yeah. So they become convinced that all the stuff they're doing is correct. So Frank has retreated back to the museum, right, to talk this out with the archaeologist. And then... Yeah. And he explains to her that it's like, look, basically, they're not wrong. I know for a fact that there is a spiritual plane. There's a spiritual plane. I am in touch with it. And he talks about how, like, he was told his powers were going to get more powerful and were going to develop in ways he didn't understand. And he's like, now that's happening. And I don't know how to deal with it, but I can tell you, like, I'm seeing stuff here that I've never seen before, and I understand what's going on. And so she asks him what he sees, and he lays out a bunch of things. He sees a longhouse, he sees the grass, he sees buffalo
coming back.
Got buffalo returning just like in their prophecy.
Yeah. And it is a very nice, I mean, whoever did it, right? The longhouse looks really good.
Oh God, yeah.
He explains it, and she says, "Oh, that's an what does she calls it?" Anyway,
she might just say Algonquin, but the point is,
yeah, it's a longhouse.
It's a longhouse.
But
right as Frank is done explaining about the stuff he sees, he gets waylaid by the guys who, of course, are completely convinced. All the lights go out and he gets waylaid by the guys who have become convinced, just as Frank is basically at this point, that he is the messenger that they're waiting for in their prophecy.
Yes. Yeah. And like, he is the one that is going to tell them what to do next.
Yep.
Right. And the lights have gone out. Frank has disappeared. The archaeologist calls the cops, like the cop that's been
dealing with this the whole time.
Whose case this is. But in the meantime, we go back and we see Frank. And Frank has been tied with it. Well, he has his hands pinned back by a wooden
bar that he's tied to. Bar, yeah.
And he is going to, he's trying to, it's because he knows somehow or another there's some truth in this, but he says no. He just keeps, or there's something anyway.
Yeah.
Right? And he is talking to these guys, right, trying to say no, and they're ready to give him the exact same.
Nah, but before the snake venom, they give him the same drugs to give you visions.
Yeah.
They give him the drugs, and he takes the drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does. he does take the drugs, and essentially takes part in their ritual.
Yeah.
Like, he absolutely does take part in the rich. He doesn't have any choice, but honestly, I don't know that he's against it.
No.
Because he wants to know, and he wants to get his spiritual connection going more powerfully, and he wants to know where this is going.
Yeah.
It's...
And he has seen the buffalo return.
Exactly.
And he has seen the longhouse. And he has seen the single blade of God. And he is, in some ways... There's something going on.
Yeah, he believes something is going on here, even if he can't explain it yet. Meanwhile, she is the archaeologist leads the cops there using Frank's vision. And so if she's like, okay, well, you know, here's how big a longhouse is. If you assume that he's being held, where is his vision? The cops are just like, we've got no idea. We might as well go with this plan. Like, we've got no idea where he is. What the hell? Tell us more. And so she lays out that, well, a longhouse is this big. And if the front of the, right, if on one end of the longhouse is the place where they did the first massacre, right, the killing of Daniel, then the second, the other end of the longhouse, the door leading to the east, sorry, to the west, would be the other end of the longhouse. So that has to be X amount of meters this way. So she leads them so many meters from the entrance of the hotel, and they see smoke coming out of a manhole cover, and they realize it's all happening down in the basement, which is, you know, completely reasonable. So they pull it open, they go down, they rescue Frank just before he's given the snake venom, thankfully.
Yeah.
And now I there's one thing I hadn't said that you need to understand for the ending of this episode.
Yes, yes.
Because at the start of the episode, there was a line that Frank got delayed behind a truck that was literally full of elephants. And then the cop explains that there's a circus in town.
Yeah.
And so then as Frank and the tribespeople are pulled out of the sewer, they're all standing around, you know, Frank, you know, like just looking a mess. All of the guys in their ritual outfits, an entire herd of buffalo goes running by.
An entire herd of buffalo.
Dozen of buffalo. And then all of the guys are like, it's happening. It's true. The prophecy is fulfilled. Yeah, and then a dozen clowns run by chasing the buffalo.
Yeah, now they don't understand that they're clowns. They see them as other Native Americans.
No, but the lead cultist turns to Frank and is like, were those clowns?
Yeah.
And again, they set it up right at the start of the episode.
Yeah.
It's such a good setup and payoff, this joke.
What they saw were buffalo, but they were really elephants.
Yes. They saw buffalo and tribesmen, but they were really the elephants and the clowns. Like, were those clowns? It's such a good... Oh, my God.
You first see them running, and they look like they are Native American men.
Exactly.
And then they turn into the clowns, right? Yeah.
It's such a good... No.
It doesn't matter, because at the end, you know, she says something to Frank. I can't remember what, but he says, no, a single blade of grass.
Yeah, the single blade of grass has grown now.
Yes.
Like, the grass is propped up, and this can't be stopped.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a good episode. It's a weird episode. Yeah. I don't know why I didn't... I mean, like you said, maybe I never saw this episode somehow.
Yeah.
But it's a good episode. It really is.
Because I think you would remember...
Would have remembered it. You'd think I would have. Yeah. But for some reason, for whatever reason, I probably didn't see this episode. But it's a good one. It's it's definitely weird. It's got a lot of strange stuff. This whole there being a secret lost tribe of the Ojibwe is kind of strange. But then again, there's plenty of strange apocrypha on this show. I don't know why this is where we draw the line, right?
Well, yeah, there is strange. Well, usually you have some, like, and I mean, they haven't talked about, because they didn't bother talking about the white buffalo, because that's part of a different group of Native Americans.
Their doomsday signs
of the end. Is the birth of white buffalo, because it was a big thing. There was a white buffalo born in Wisconsin. This was all part and parcel. I won't bore you with all of those details, but it is the same sort of thing. The buffalo will come back. And I would suggest that if anybody wants to read a book, there's a book called Green Grass Running Water. And it's something that I have read it more than once. It takes a while for people to get what's going on in it. It's by Thomas King.
Okay.
Written by Thomas King about, it is very, very strange, because you have the trickster, you know, you have the coyote, and you have a dog, and you have these spirit elders, right? Okay. But you don't know that that's what they are in the beginning, like, because it's broken into these chapters and things are happening in the real world. And then you have, so you have a discussion of the Trail of Tears,
right?
And you have the discussion of, you know, Buffalo coming back, and you have sort of discussions of Native Americans going down and working in Hollywood, like that. That's part of the real world stuff that's overlain by these guys. You gradually understand that they are interacting and they interfere. You know, and they interfere in people's lives, right? And so the ending is an absolute riot. But I can remember I use it often in my when I used to teach anthropology,
right?
And Native ethnology of Native North America, and it would be a 6-credit course, so I had lots of room to move.
Yeah.
And this was one book I made them read, and I can still remember one woman, and she had been a 60s scoop child.
Oh, damn. For people who don't know, that was when they go and they get in an attempt to destroy Native cultures in Canada. They just kidnapped all the children and had them taken to schools where they were either murdered or adopted by white families.
Oh, no. The 60s scoop was specifically not to put them into residential schools, but to put them into white homes.
Yeah. To destroy their culture and embrace, yeah, and make them fully "quote unquote" Canadian.
Yeah, yeah. So then that was in the '50s and the '60s, right? Mm-hmm. And so I can still remember her saying, "Well, you know, I read this before and I didn't understand it. But now I do." Because I did have to do some explaining.
Of course.
As they are reading this book, I used it again just recently, because it does have a Native American woman who is an archaeologist who works, or a historian who works at the University of Alberta.
Oh.
Because I'll take this class. Right. And you remember Dead Dog Cafe?
Of course.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the prototype of the Dead Dog Cafe is in this book.
Oh, weird.
Yeah. The cafe. Well, no, because it was Thomas King.
Yeah.
Who was part of Dead Dog Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But anyway, the author, and he was actually an English prof at the University of Guelph, and his mother was Cherokee. I think.
Okay.
Yeah. No, he's not a white person writing about Native American.
I didn't things. Think he was. Don't worry.
Canadian, or Native Canadian things. But yes, yeah. No, he was. Yeah.
Okay.
But it's called Green Grass, Running Water. And it does go with this idea of a single blade of grass. Yeah. And then there's the problem. There is the issue of the water, right? Because part of what's going on here, too, is trying to stop this dam from being built, right?
All right. But we're going to move on from this book, which
and
does sound interesting.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting episode.
Yeah,
but
it is.
But I'm going to say that of the two, the better episode is The Curse of Frank Black.
Well, yeah, but the curse of Frank, but
which
the
is
curse
the next
of Frank Black, which is what we're moving on to. I don't even know if you can call it better or worse. It is almost unique.
It is unlike any, because remember how I said last, when we were talking about last season, when we were trying to decide what the show was, right?
Yeah.
And how one of the strange things about the show Millennium is when you turned on, and one of the reasons we thought that it couldn't be successful in the end is when you turned on an episode of Millennium, you had no idea what you were going to get.
Yeah.
From week to week. Right.
And just that single blade of grass is one indication of that.
Yeah, it is. But a much better indication of that is The Curse of Frank Black.
Yes. It's considered by IMDb as top rated.
Yeah. As the best episode of the show. And I understand why. It is magnificent. Like, this is a fantastic hour of television. It is.
Yeah, it is.
It's
so,
just great.
It is so. It is. Yes. But it is. The funny thing is that when I'm talking about The Curse of Frank Black.
Yeah.
I go. There is Like, you can't, it's almost like it has to stand by itself.
I know.
It's like commentary on Frank Black's life.
It is.
And as opposed to fitting into the entire structure, it's like an addendum.
Yeah, it is.
To the entire series, or it could be a prologue to the entire series or something. And it's right in the middle, almost in the middle of the 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it is.
It's a challenging episode of television.
Yes. And the thing is that if we were doing season two and saying best and worst or whatever.
Which we will be doing soon enough.
Well, it's almost as if The Curse of Frank Black has to get its own special category.
I know.
Because it can't be compared to any of the other ones before.
It's entirely its own thing.
Yes.
This is not an episode about, you know, somebody trying to catch a serial killer. This is not an episode about weird apocrypha. Yes, there is a demon in this episode. Yes, there is a ghost in this episode. Right? There's a demon watching Frank for most of this episode. Yes, God is involved in this episode. But at the same time, it doesn't have the kind of plot you would assume you would associate with every single other episode of Millennium.
Exactly.
It doesn't have that.
It doesn't have a real plot.
No.
As such.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't have a real plot.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk when we get to the end about the end. But yeah, I mean, it is so interesting right from the beginning, right? Because we see Frank, it's Halloween night.
Yep.
Frank is going to be taking,
Jordan trick-or-treating.
Out trick-or-treating. And he's carving a
jack-o'-lantern.
It's a really good jack-o'-lantern.
Oh yeah, he's great at this.
Right? And then he has a candle and he puts the candle in.
By the way, Frank being great with a knife, message that comes up twice in the episode. Once with the jack-o'-lantern and once later on, which we'll get to. But it's notable that they set that up.
Yes. And then Frank is going to be handing out candy. And, you know, he has an unsuccessful with... these two kids come.
Yeah, these two kids dress as football players, and they look at him, and they find him creepy, and they move on to the next house.
Yeah, they move on to the next house by the time he gets out, and then he just decides, oh, the hell with this.
Yeah.
Right? And after he leaves the house, the jack-o'-lantern turns back on.
Yep. And it's important, of course, that he only had the one match. They had a matchbook with one match in it, and that match did not succeed in lighting the jack-o'-lantern.
Yes.
That is the important part of information that they got to establish here.
Yeah, and they did right at the beginning.
Right at the beginning.
Out, and then the candle goes on.
Yeah, the candle goes on anyway.
And this is probably a two-hour candle, so the entire episode takes about 2 hours.
Exactly. Is set over that next 2 hours, because when he finally gets home, the candle is burning down.
Yeah, it's right down to its last quarter inch or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so he goes out. So we see him going, Aunt Jordan, walking Jordan from house to house. And the music, and you just have this really feeling of unease, because it shouldn't yet. Although the candle coming on,
it's a little creepy. Oh, and it's notable. And I mean, right away, when the two kids walk away from his house, the demon's already there.
Yes, the demon is out on the...
The porch. Like, it's out at the hedgerow watching him from the edge.
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of demon we saw with Lucy Butler back in that episode.
Yeah.
So it's like, we know, watching, this is a demon watching Frank.
Yeah. But Frank goes off.
Frank goes off. Jordan. And he's taking her from house to house dressed as Marge Simpson because of cross-promotion with Fox.
Yes, that was an adorable costume, though.
Yeah, it was a fantastic costume. No notes on that costume. They did a great job.
No notes on that costume. That was a perfect Marge Simpson.
Oh, yeah, it was great. Right, he's taking her, and there's one house she doesn't want to go into because it's creepy.
But I'd already noticed Now, that's the funny thing. By this point, I'd already noticed that we've got three 26-8s.
26-8s. Okay, good. I was wondering because...
168.
Yeah. Like, because it's very clear. Like, it's very clear on the matchbox. The 268 on the matchbox. I was wondering if you'd noticed the one on the candle.
Yeah. No, I didn't notice the one on the candle.
Yes,
but
the
I
price
did
of the candle the as well. Yeah.
Oh, no, but, you did but see that the was boys. Later.
No,
later.
You see it right up front. He shows it again, he's unwrapping the candle, you can clearly see the price tag the first time.
Yeah, but I didn't see the price tag the first
time. So you saw the boys, and you saw the matchbook, and then you saw
like,
the house.
And I'm going, but okay. Frank's house isn't at, like, and the number to Frank's house was already 2...
No, it's Ezekiel 1218, or something like that.
No, that's what it's supposed to be, but there was a...
Oh, yeah, they changed, yes, yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
That's the other house, right? That the other house is Ezekiel. This house that he's living in now, which is not the original house.
Yes.
268. And then the house that Jordan won't go into
is also a 268.
And I keep going, what is this? 268, right?
Well, so as I remember when I was doing the review of that movie about the advent calendar, I'm like, look, whenever you see a couple of weird numbers, it's always a Bible reference, and you just got to figure out what Bible reference it is. Luckily, the show tells us. We don't have to look it up.
Well, yeah, what are we going to do? Go through every 26?
Yes, 26-8. It's going to take a while.
It's going to take a while.
Plenty of the books in that Bible.
Yeah, and it's brilliant in how it shows it.
Oh, but we'll get to that when we get to that. The important part is that Frank flashes back to his own experience with the creepy house on the block that people didn't want to go into. And we see him as a 5-year-old remembering being dared by the other kids to be the one to go in and try and get candy from the house, and being like, all the kids being like, you go in, and if you get candy, we split it, and if you don't come out, we'll call the cops.
In 5 minutes. If you don't come out,
we'll call the cops and you'll be fine.
Well, what they did was an eeny, meeny, miny, moe. And the problem is that Frank was just mesmerized by the house.
Yeah, and he was not
so
paying
attention.
So he's
probably had the feeling to that house that Jordan is talking about to the house.
Absolutely, that's what's happening.
Okay, and what really pissed me off, though, is Frank says, no, Jordan, there's no such thing as ghosts, because Jordan says there are ghosts in that house.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank says, there's no such thing as ghosts. And I'm
like,
going,
Frank,
God,
you know better
Frank,
than that. Come on.
You already said you would support Jordan when she starts to have these feelings.
But it's Halloween. It's Halloween. He doesn't want her to be too freaked out. I get that. I get where he's coming from here. Anyway,
yes,
the point is, he not the child Frank at 5 years old knocks on the door.
I'd say he was 7.
No, it says at the end credits he's 5 years old.
Yes.
I checked. Yes, it does. Okay. It's 5-year-old Frank. And behind the door is Dean Winters, whom we love ever since we saw him on Oz. Oh, I guess technically ever since we saw him on this, since this was like before Oz.
Yeah.
Or contemporaneous to Oz, maybe. But the point is, Dean Winters, who's fantastic. And it's such an interesting choice, right? For the messenger. Because it's like, you don't expect the messenger to be just like a guy from Brooklyn.
No.
And that's why he makes such an interesting choice for who to cast for this part. Because, so Frank says trick or treat, and he says, okay, I'll give you a treat if you do a trick for me. And he explains the origin of Halloween and says, do you believe that people can come back?
Yeah.
And he says, because I've got a lot of people that I would like to hear from. So tell me if you believe they can come back tonight. And this scene is taking place right after World War II. And we see all over his walls are pictures of him and his army buddies. And you're like, oh God, everybody he knew got killed in World War II.
Yeah.
Like everybody died except for him. Yeah. And he's the only one left. And so you understand that this is a man with PTSD. This is a man who's hopeless. And what does Frank say? What does 5-year-old Frank say? 5-year-old Frank says there's no such thing as ghosts.
Yeah.
Which is not what that guy needed to hear.
No. Well, he's 5 years old.
He's 5 years old. What were you expecting, right? But the important part is You know, Dean Winters says, he says, can I have a treat now? And Dean Winters offers him a cigarette.
Yeah. And then he walks out.
And then he walks out. Oh my God, it's such a great moment. So
no, it was a really good scene with Dean Winters, because you kind of creepy, but you can just see that, you know, it's not the
he's not threatening at all. He's just hopeless. No,
he's just hopeless. He's got nobody left, and mm-hmm. There's nobody he can interact with.
Yeah,
and everybody's kind of afraid of him. Which of these? Yeah. Guys, this is Frank and his buddies.
Yeah, they're scared of this. This is this house where the scary guy lives.
Yeah,
this is the house that you're not supposed to trick or treat at.
Yeah,
like there's a house like that in every neighborhood, you know. And the oh my God, well, and we'll talk about the payoff later. But the best part, though, how great is the just the performance of that kid versus Dean Winters, of like the kid who has manages to sell that he's got no idea what this guy is talking about. Like the polite young version of Frank, who's just waiting for the adult to stop talking. I thought the kid was great. I thought the kid playing young Frank was great.
Oh no. He pulled young Frank off.
Yeah. They cast that perfectly.
Yeah. Teenage Frank wasn't quite as good.
No,
he wasn't cast quite as well, but this one was perfect, and he got even the hand motion. You knew, like when you first
right away,
and then this kid makes a hand motion. You go, "Oh, that one is
that's Frank." Frank. Yeah. Right away, you recognize it.
You recognize that he's Frank, so he gets to go inside, and but I mean, they cheated at their eeny meeny miny mo.
Of course, they did to make Frank go
at the house. Yeah. And I think Frank was probably staring at the house because he had a feeling about the house.
Oh, yeah, because he already was experiencing these, if not visions per se, yet. He already had this connection.
Yeah, like Jordan does. That's why this memory comes up.
Yeah. So he goes to check on, he starts driving, right? He's dropped Jordan off, and he's going driving back, and he can't get the CD to work.
Yeah, the CD just won't work.
CD just refuses to work. And then when his car hits 26.8.
Yeah, it stops.
It dies on him. The electrical completely.
Oh, plus he turns on the radio and the radio stops at 26.8 and plays this song about the devil, right?
Yep.
And then the car turns over until it gets to 26.8 and it stops dead.
And it stops dead and he's left wandering out and he's like, I need to find a phone. I need to call somebody to help with the car. He's walking around. He can't find anybody to help him. A little joke for people who loved, he runs up to a guy in a suit, right? In this big suit, asking if he's got a cell phone. The guy kind of looks like a cell phone, he says. And then Frank says, what are you even supposed to be? And the joke there is that the suit is the alien, is one of the alien flight suits from Space Above and Beyond. Glenn Morgan and James Wong's previous show that had been such a failure. So the joke is nobody has any idea what this costume is supposed to be because the show was a failure. So it's just a cute little self-deprecating joke by those two. That I respected them for putting that in. But the point is, Frank suddenly looks up and realizes that he's outside the yellow house.
Yes.
Oh. And so, of course, you know, he realizes this must be important. Right?
Yes, but he also is looking around and he sees a shadow in the basement.
Yep. And so he goes to investigate.
So he and goes inside.
Now the house. And suddenly we find out what the title of the episode is referring to.
Yeah. So there's this. So they're doing the ghost run of the houses, right?
Yep.
So this guy has brought some of his friends into the house to tell the story of Frank Black and about
the curse of Frank Black.
The curse of Frank Black and that,
yep.
And that the ghost of Brian.
Bob Bletcher, still trapped in the house.
And cannot leave until the curse of Frank Black is lifted. He's telling the story of Frank's sitting there listening to it, right?
Yep.
And then he comes down the stairs and says, well, or unless he comes downstairs, yeah, right? Yeah, and the kids
he runs off the kids, telling them to leave their beer.
Yeah.
But what's nice is this thing for, that, so they tell the story of Bob, but in the story, it's interesting, of course, they get some of the details wrong, because it's just teenagers, yeah, and they have thin. So they think it's Bob's kidney that was in the fridge, rather than the kidney of the serial killer.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a nice touch, because it shows you how, like, the stories get naturally adapted. Muddled. They get muddled, they get adapted, people forget details. Like, little notes like that are why that's such a great scene.
Yeah, and you know, it was a great scene, because he's telling it, and you can just see at parts when he's telling the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
That some of them are getting a little tense.
Right? Yeah.
Just a little tense.
It's a creepy house. It's Halloween. If a ghost was going to show up, tonight would be the night.
Yeah, and this house, I mean, I still, yes. I mean, I know that Frank has said, no, nobody's going to live in it until we come back to it.
And as a family. Going, yeah.
You know, yes, but come on.
I know, here in right?
It's supposed to be enormous.
It is. Oh my God. So then he goes out, right? And he sees the, he sees someone had left a carton of eggs, right?
Yeah.
And he winds up grabbing one and throwing eggs at his own house.
Yes. And then we see the demon face in one of the eggs on the window.
Yeah. The yolk has created a demon face where it splatted against the window. And another nice touch. So, yeah, it's like, we know what's going on here.
Yeah.
So Frank goes back to his new house.
Yeah.
And the TV starts going nuts, just like the radio went nuts.
Yeah.
And the sports scores are 26, 268 again, right? 26, and this wonderful animation of the, like, some kind of a stop-motion animation, the devil keeps popping up.
Yeah.
And, along with the song, and he can't turn it off.
Frank did notice right away that the candle had burned down.
Yep, the candle came back on. He collects his mail, and it's all junk mail from four different organizations. But the initials of all four different organizations are ACTS.
Yes, no. But he doesn't make that
He doesn't notice it right away, until, no.
Yeah. Until, because he had to break into his own house because the front door wouldn't work.
Yep.
And so
the security guard turns up.
He's got a security system that's ACTS,
mm-hmm.
and this guy, right? And then Frank goes, ACTS, at. And then he looks at all of the mail and goes, every ACTS.
Well, no, and the key part is, even the license plate of the guy's security car is ACTS 268.
Yeah, so he finally gets it. Okay, let's go pull our New Testament down.
Yeah, let's go open up the Book of Acts.
Yes. 26.
And if you go to Acts 26:8, it says, you know, why are you surprised that God would be able to raise the dead?
Yes.
Are you truly surprised that our Lord would be able to raise the dead? And you have this wonderful moment of him say, like, I did love when he says to, like, Bob, if, you know, ever there was a night that you wanted to come and say hi, tonight would be the night. You know, if you got a message, I'm here.
He saw Bob once.
He did.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he sees, well, because he sees Bob when he's in the basement, looking up the stairs, he sees someone hanging the same way Bob was. But then it turns, you know, just turns out to have been a shadow in his head. But, you know, we know what's going on.
Yeah. So then he hears noises.
Yep.
And then something falls mm-hmm. in his closet, in this closet that has the doorway to the
attic,
where he can climb up to the attic. So he goes up to the attic. And what's in the attic? But
Dean Winters is waiting for him.
Is back.
Yeah. Oh, my God. What a scene this is.
Yes, this is because.
Oh, my God. What a scene this is.
I mean, the assumption is he must have committed suicide.
Oh, no, yeah, because we didn't mention, but Frank has a second flashback,
yeah.
right, about how 10 years after that night, right, when he ran into Dean Winters, he and his friends saw you know, Dean Winter's dead body being carted out. And, you know, one guy says he was gay, and one guy says that he was a commie, and one guy says he was a serial killer, even though they didn't have the word serial killer yet. And Frank says, no, he killed himself. Because Frank knows, because Frank can sense this stuff, even then. His one friend is like, yeah, well, you know, he was a gay serial killer. Of course he killed himself. But they're universal in their belief that if you kill yourself, you're going to hell. And that's the key part. And now he's back.
And he says, hell isn't what you think it is.
Yeah, it's not, you know, it's not demon stabbing. It's not all that. It's just this whole, you know, this one thing repeated forever and ever
I'm going to be smoking this damn cigarette for the forever.
Forever.
Why didn't I quit?
Yeah. What? And so he tells Frank that he got sent back because Frank has turned into him. That Frank is now the creepy guy who no one wants to go into the house. He's the guy that people tell stories about.
Yeah. Right?
He's the guy. And eventually, if you, you know, let that drag on, you start to believe them yourself.
Yep.
And you forget that you were anything but this creepy monster at some point. And then we get the beautiful moment where he says that he has been sent to offer Frank a deal.
Yep.
Which is, judgment day is coming. The devil is going to win. And all you have to do, and there is a place will be set aside for you and your wife and your daughter in the new world beyond. All you have to do is sit it out.
Yeah, just sit it out.
Just sit it out.
Yeah, he doesn't have to do anything. He doesn't have to be evil.
Nope.
He doesn't have to join that lawyer. Nothing.
Nope.
Everything else has been sort of put in front of him before. Now this is just, Frank, just go back to your wife. Go back to your daughter.
Go back to your yellow house.
Yeah. Go back to your yellow house.
And as Dean Winter said, I saw what you did to that guy who kidnapped your wife. I feel like you should be getting a better offer than this. You could be on our side. But no, the deal is you just sit it out. And we won't make trouble for you. And there will be a place for you when this is all over. And that's the offer. And then you get this great moment where Frank says to, it's like, he's going to win, you know, and it's coming soon. And Frank says, when? It's the last line of the episode. Frank says, when? And Dean Winters has disappeared by the time he turns around. And Frank hears a beeping from downstairs. And his question is answered because right there on the computer, which has turned on, is the login screen for the Millennium Group that says, welcome, Frank. There are 790 days remaining. You wanted to know when? There it is right in front of you. Oh, my God, this episode.
And then you see him. And this is how it leaves it, because he doesn't say one thing or another.
Nope.
He nothing else going on except that he goes back to the Yellow House and he watches.
He washes the eggs off of the Yellow House.
Yeah.
Because Dean Winters had mentioned that it's like, that one of the things he thought, you know, is a perfect example of Frank losing it is that he's trashing his own house. And he says, I did that one time. I grabbed some dog crap out of my backyard and I threw it up my window, my kitchen window, and I never cleaned it off. And he's like, can you believe that? Someone doing that to their own house?
Yep.
And Frank realizes, like, he's not someone who can give up. He's not someone who can ever stop trying.
But but there's another way to read that.
Yeah.
Okay, because even though that's what Dean Winter said, the other way to read that is that he's going to, maybe he's considering the offer of sitting it out.
Well, I mean, you can debate that. I think you can read it that way. But the fact that he specifically goes and he doesn't let the house become decrepit. That he's trying to fix it and he's trying to make it better. But you're right. I mean, I'm not saying he doesn't consider it.
Like,
I am saying, we don't know.
We have no idea why he is
thinking.
What he means when he goes and cleans the house up.
That's
he
true. Has
some kind of a decision.
Yeah.
Right?
But you can read it my way or you can read it your way. And given the events of this episode, either one is completely valid.
Yeah. And either one just means he hasn't, or he just hasn't, he hasn't made a decision, but he's going to clean up the house. Like that was.
Because you're right. Whether he's continuing to fight or whether he's decided to just go back and sit it out, either way, he needs the house.
He needs the house. And he needs to do something.
Yeah.
He's got to make a decision. I don't think that you can.
But he does look the devil in the eye before he starts cleaning the house. Because the devil is sitting inside the house looking at him.
Yeah.
And he looks it right in the eye before he starts cleaning the egg off the window.
Yep.
So that's why I choose to read it as him turning down the offer. But I understand why you would say that it is ambiguous, and I'm not going to argue. I think it is ambiguous.
I think it's ambiguous. He washes, because he does wash the devil off first.
Exactly. That's why it is less ambiguous to me than it might be otherwise, because the first thing he does is wash off the devil face.
Yeah.
But you're right that it's like, we don't get a firm statement of what Frank is thinking at that moment.
Because he never tells Dean Winters, I'm going to turn.
No.
He never gets the chance to say.
Nope. Dean Winters disappears.
Yeah.
Ugh, it's such a good episode.
It is. No, it's a really good episode.
There's nothing like it.
No.
You know, there's no answers provided by this episode. Like, we talk about how Millennium is a show that, you know, gets off on not letting you understand or like not giving you a firm answer. And like, this episode is the perfect example of that.
Yeah.
You know, this is the one where he meets the ghost of Dean Winters and he gets offered a deal by the devil, and it ends with him cleaning egg off of a house that he put there. Yeah. it's such a weird episode of television.
Thinking of it, when you watch it the first time, you're not sure what decision he's made.
No. Obviously, I think, you know, we understand later on, but when you watch the episode, I don't think it is clear. But,
no, it's not.
Oh, my God.
Actually just be considering it for a little while.
It wouldn't shock me. I mean, I completely agree that you can read it that way. And again, I'm probably bringing, but it's worth mentioning about this episode, which is such a fantastic episode of television, how much of it is silent.
Yes. Yeah, most of it is like Frank.
There's almost no dialogue in this episode of television.
And Frank has the least amount of dialogue of anybody in this. Other than Jordan, maybe Jordan has less dialogue than Frank. Yeah. But
that's it.
Everybody else has more
dialogue. You know, the kid telling the story, Dean Winters gets two monologues. Frank says almost nothing this entire episode.
Yep.
Like, the kid gets a monologue about Bob. Dean Winters gets his monologue to child Frank and to adult Frank. Right? Yep.
His friends get to talk more than he does.
Exactly. His friends talk more than child Frank. Like, yeah. In both cases, when he's a kid and when he's a teenager, his friends do all the talking and he just gets like one or two lines both times. Frank is almost like Frank, the character who spends most of the time explaining stuff to us. Is completely silent for this episode.
Yep.
Right to the end. Where again, and that's the key thing. The last line is when.
Yeah.
That's the last line of the episode. Because all the stuff that happens with him cleaning off the window the next day and seeing the demon, that all goes uncommented on. There's no extra dialogue for that.
Nope.
Oh. It's a great episode of television.
Oh no, it's a fantastic episode to watch.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a great episode of television, but it's an episode of television. It's not one of those things where you could say, oh, well, watch this to understand how great the episode of the show is. Because this would be gibberish.
Yeah.
If you hadn't watched the rest of the show.
Yeah, if you haven't watched the episodes up to now, this makes no sense.
No, this would make no sense whatsoever. But it is. It's a special hour of television.
Yeah.
And it really does reinforce that idea I was talking about, where it's like, you tuned in Friday night at 9 o'clock, and you had no idea what you were going to get.
Yep.
Like, week to week, you had no idea what you were going to get. And this is maybe the best example of that. Other than Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense, which, if not next week, is the week after.
It's the week after.
We're closing in on Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense, which I want to guess is episode 9?
Yep.
Oh, so proud I remembered that. All right, so what's next week?
Next week is something called 1919, I'm sure, another biblical verse.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, and then The Hand of Saint Sebastian.
Well, I don't remember based on the titles, but I look forward to finding out what it is. Oh, God, I'm so embarrassed. We forgot to mention one thing in the end of the Bad Seed episode last week, so I think we should address it now. We didn't say what happened to the little girl at the end of the episode. That at the end of the episode where she's doing the Three Little Pigs story, right? I know, it's so embarrassing. We see the parents handing off the kid to the sheriff is walking up with a couple of guys in suits, and she's happy to hand her daughter over. And then we see the daughter sitting around a table in this like farmhouse looking place with a bunch of other kids and a mother and a father. And then in the background is a computer with the Millennium Group logo on it. So the Millennium Group has halfway house for disturbed children. And we don't know why. But yeah, just something to keep in mind when you're thinking about the Millennium Group going forward.
The Millennium Group is.
Exactly. What they are and what they want. All right. So that's that. Yeah. If you have any questions, if you have any comments, if there's any profiling related fiction you'd like us to check out, drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. If you are listening to this on an app or a podcast, please be sure to rate and review it. That's how new people find the show. Kind of crazy, isn't it? There used to be so much TV produced that a Halloween episode could be the 6th episode of a season.
Yeah.
Like, that's a lot of television. Anyway, we'll see you back here next week for episodes 7 and 8 of Millennium Season 2. But until then, I'll say that's right. Au revoir.
Have a good week.